the astronomers got a signal that spelled, you know, first you got a beep, one, and then two, and then three, and all the way up to 101. And they concluded that this cannot be a result of any natural process. So they actually concluded until they designed that movie. And I might come a little back to this example. Here is another example. You know, those who are publishing maps, how do they protect their copyrights? Also, you know, maps is an example. Also, before we had electronic calculators, then everyone had tables of logarithms and sinus and cosinus and like that. Anyone?
Yeah.
That all? Yeah. You know. So. So also how would they the publishers of in the cosinus or sinus table, how would they protect their copyrights? Because how do you do? You cannot make a copyright of the right answer or a map. How it's not your. You just make a copy of something that's already there.
Yeah.
You cannot copyright the land or the country. So how would the publishers of maps protect their copyrights, or publishers of mathematical tables protect their copyrights? Any idea?
They cannot do that.
No, but actually they had a way.
Who published?
Yeah, what?
Whoever published it first and say I have published in this particular table.
Yeah, but again, it's like. You know, I have copyright on 2 + 2 = 4. After I was the first, then nobody else can write that in the books, because that doesn't work like that. You cannot.
Maybe they add something of less significance to make it distinct.
Yeah, actually, that's the answer. They actually, add a few mistakes here and there. For example, on the tables, logarithmic tables, on the 7th and the 8th decimal, there might be a small mistake, which doesn't affect anyone. I mean, nobody needs 8 decimals anyway. But, you cannot copy, you have no copyright on the right answer. But if someone, has made also publish a table and have all the right ones, that we cannot. But if they also have precisely the same mistakes, then we can say, you have copied. And similarly with also with maps, they will also add a town that's not there, for example, or a mountain or something. There'll be some subtle things, small things, but it'll be some. And that's how they protect the copyrights. So someone, if there is a court case, then they can actually assist use design detection and say, no, here we have. Plagiarism. So that's another, instance where this discussion is this chance or deliberate fraud? And so with these examples, I want to ask a question: how do we infer intelligent design? And here, one use what is called Dembski explanatory filter. And And now this is going to look a little technical for you. I don't know if you can get what this says, but this is a mathematical filter or design filter where you can you of course begin with the start, and then you have to ask 3 questions, and if you can say yes to each of these questions, then you have a feature that is intelligent designed. I'll give you an example. Have 3 strings of letters. Can we conclude that these were designed or not? First one is this, T-O. Can we conclude that this was intelligent design? It's the first question one has to ask, was this contingent? And what does that mean? Contingent means it's something that must happen. You know, actually, we imagine now we have a keyboard and we have a monkey. That's actually what we're testing. And we have a suspicion, actually it's not an ordinary monkey, it's an intelligent monkey. So we let the monkey type something. And here is the first thing that the monkey types. So the first question, contingent, did it have to type T-O? And the answer is no, it's not something that had to happen. Contingent things that happen is something like if I let this go, this is contingent. It will fall all the time. It's a law. So, I mean, that if it's contingent, it means it's the opposite. It's something that that doesn't have to happen. That's what the word contingent means. So it didn't have to, the monkey didn't have to write T-O. So it's contingent, yes. The next question is it complex? And here we have to answer, no, it is not complex. T-O is very simple, it's just two letters, isn't it? So that's simple. So we cannot conclude, it could just be chance, that the monkey just boom, boom, and T-O, that was. So then we get the next string of letters here. A number of letters like that. And again, we asked, was this contingent? No, it could have been any other string of letters. Then the next question is it complex? And the answer actually, it's very complex. It's probably so complex that probably never before in the history of mankind, maybe not even in the history of the universe, has this string of letters come out precisely as there. So it's very, very complex, a string of letters. Is that clear? Complex? But then we have to ask, is it specified? And we will, I'll get back to what that means, specified. But here, even though it's very complex, we will conclude probably it was chance. The monkey was just, you know, punching here and there. And it looks like, I mean, it could easily be chance. So the point here is actually that just because something is very complex doesn't mean that it is not chance. Complex things happen all the time by chance. So sometimes someone will make an argument for design by saying, oh, this was very complex. But actually, that's not strong enough, that argument. You can have all kinds of complex things happen all the time by chance. So, so we cannot exclude chance here. Here we have, let's see here. Here we have another string of letters, which, I mean, it's contingent. It's not a string of letters that had to, could be any other string of letters. It's complex. It's definitely a complex string of letters. It's as complex as the string above. But besides being both contingent and complex, it's also specified. It means it carries an independently given meaning. It's actually to be or not to be, that is the question. It's a sentence from Hamlet, Shakespeare's Hamlet. So specified means it's an independent pattern exists that corresponds to this trait or event or string of letters. Do my words make sense? Hamlet exists independently of this string of letters. It existed before the string of letters were written. And still, we have the same sentence as in Hamlet. So, if you have some independently existing pattern that matches the pattern you're studying, then you can say, this is not chance, this must be design. And even if Shakespeare had not written that, you still would have said, this is not chance, because it has meaning. It has an independently existing meaning, independent of this string of letters. And this is called specified complexity. And according to this, it's a complex feature that matches an independently existing pattern. Everyone understand?
Not quite. A complex feature that
matches an independently existing pattern. I mean, a complex feature, you understand? And the investigation, we find there is a pattern existing independently that matches this complex feature. For example, when the astronomers in the movie Contact concluded that these sequence of the prime numbers up to 101, this cannot be chance, this is designed. Why? How did they conclude that? Because the prime numbers exist independently. It's a mathematical significant string or sequence of numbers that exist independently of this signal that they got from, you know, in the film. You understand? Prime numbers exist independently, and here they have a signal that prime numbers. This is, I mean, this is beyond reasonable to say that this can be chance. We also sometimes give the example of, you know, the Big Bang building company. You know about this example? Big Bang, have you?
Oh,
okay. That's I mean, it's a joke we do often make that it's a Big Bang building company. And the way this Big Bang building company is constructing buildings, and actually they're very cheap, so people they say, this sounds really good, how can you build something like that cheap? So someone they hires this Big Bang building company and says, this is interesting, but we'd like, just like to know, how do you, you know, what is your constructive method? And then the constructor said, it's very, very simple. We just get a big pile of bricks, you know, big pile of bricks, and the windows, and the pipes, and everything, and the fittings, and like that. And then we just place dynamite under the whole thing, and then we blow up the whole thing. And then, when the whole thing has, you know, exploded, and the dust has settled, then the building is there, ready, and you move in. This is how the universe was constructed with the Big Bang. This is how we make buildings here. So we know that that's not possible. I mean, of course, we say it could happen by chance. You know, you cannot exclude chance completely. But the probability for something like this to happen is so vanishingly small that it's not reasonable to assume it could happen. It's not likely that anything like that has ever happened anywhere in the whole universe for the last 14.5 billion years since Big Bang happened, according to the modern cosmologists. And why not? Because it matches an independent given pattern, a livable house you can move in and live in. It's independent existing pattern of the scattered bricks that, you know, or just on the bricks. So, you understand a little what might say specify complexity. So that argument has been given by this William Dembski. He's a mathematician and philosopher, and he has formalized, he's analyzed, you know, how do we complete design. He says that specified complexity is what allows us to complete design, intelligent design.
I was just wondering about the sentence, to be or not to be, that is the question. If the specified pattern of that was language?
Yeah, it's language, it's meaning. It has meaning. I mean, in this case, it existed independently before in Shakespeare's work, Hamlet. Even if that sentence, Shakespeare had not written that sentence, but you created another meaningful sentence that maybe was the first time you spoke that, but anyone spoke that. Still, you can say, because meaning is independently existing of the string of letters, you still conclude this is not chance. So that's a little, you know, technical discussion. How do we conclude design? Now I'm going to give you some example where it's reasonable to conclude. Here we actually are having design. I'm going to look a little at the universe and look at what is called the anthropological principle, which means that it's the fact that the universe appears to be fine-tuned for life or human life. In other words, there are so many physical constants and factors in the universe that seem to be very, very precise, And if they were not precisely, didn't have these precise values which they have, actually life would not be possible on a planet like this Earth. That's actually the anthropological principle. It's a, yeah, a number of physical constants have precise values that make life possible. If gravity, mass, density, strong and weak forces inside the atom, etc., were only slightly greater or smaller, life wouldn't be possible. And this is something that has cosmologists have discovered over the last decades, actually. Here there's one, Fred Hoyle, a British astronomer, who became very famous, and in the 1980s he was actually originally an atheist, and he was a very famous astronomer. A couple of generations ago, or between one or two generations ago, there was a big discussion among the cosmologists about Big Bang or steady state. And that was before they concluded that there had been a Big Bang. So there were two theories about the origin of the universe. One was called steady state, which was a theory that the universe had always existed. And the other theory was Big Bang. The universe had a beginning and has expanded from that point from where it began. And so there was a lot of discussion forth and back. And Fred Hoyle, he was the main proponent, or one of the main proponents of the steady state theory. And actually most astronomers like the steady state because Big Bang smells of God. Actually, that was a problem. You know, if it had a beginning, sound like creation or something like that. So actually most astronomers, they favored steady state and had different theories. And Fred Hoyle had a theory how possibly it could be that steady state was the universe that always had been, but as years went on, he had to change his mind, and he actually in 1982 he came out very openly and said actually there must be a God, and of course as a result he was completely sidetracked, and he became like a renegade, He writes here, I do not believe that any scientist who examines the evidence would fail to draw the inference that the laws of physics have been deliberately designed with regard to the consequences it produced inside the stars. And I'm not going to give you into detail, but it's something about the formation of elements and like that. You can read it in my book, this whole chapter on cosmology and like that. There's a discussion there. Here there's another physicist who writes, imagine playing God with the cosmos. Before you is a designer machine that lets you tinker with the basics of physics. Swiddle this knob and you make all electrons a bit lighter. Swiddle that one and you make gravity a bit stronger. You need to set 30-something knobs to fully describe the world about us. The crucial point is some of these metaphorical knobs must be tuned very precisely, or the universe would be sterile. Oh, it must be. No, one slide missing. He goes on to give an example about neutrons. If you know the nucleus of an atom, there are protons and there are neutrons inside the nucleus. And how is it? And then there's electrons spinning around the nucleus. But inside the nucleus, you have protons, which are charged, and then you have neutrons, which have no electrical charge. And let me just see if I can get it right, but is it that neutrons are slightly lighter than protons? Or is it the other way around? I'm not sure, but he writes this as an example that if it had been the other way around, then none of the processes inside atoms, which are crucial for matter to function at all, they wouldn't have been possible. Wouldn't have been possible at all. some of this light fill up. It's kind of neat. And his conclusion is that it's actually, it says it's so perfect that there's some of these physical constants that if they are just 1% or even 1/10 of a percent slightly larger mm-hmm. or smaller, the universe would not have been possible as we know it now. And there's nothing about matter or the laws of physics as such that specifies that it must have these precise values, that gravity must have precisely this strength that gravity has, and electromagnetism is a precise of this strength, and the relation between electromagnetism and gravity and so on. It could have been any other, have had any other than, bigger or smaller, but just happened to be so precisely right that ultimately life is possible here. So that's actually an argument for design and specified complexity. Life is a very specified thing, and here you have laws of physics which are just fitting to allow life like we see it here. Here is another thing, and this is something I'd like to, I was planning to discuss for the rest. Can we just go on like that last time? Or?
There are scheduled classes at the 7:30.
It's a class, Bhagavad Gita class?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So probably I'll spill over, continue next time with this, because this is a little complex, very fascinating. This is something really fascinating. Here, that's probably where when we start looking at biology. Now we can really see that this is really design we're dealing with. But in order to understand this, we have to have a little biochemistry and have a little look at particularly DNA. So I wanted to discuss the DNA. Of course, we all heard the DNA, and everyone knows what the DNA looks like.
You just showed us.
Yeah, I showed you here. But yeah. Huh?
You told us it's a complex structure with written on data on every string.
I mentioned that last time. So I wanted to get a little more into with this. But here we have a quote from Bill Gates. We all know Bill Gates, Microsoft, computer guru, software guru. And he wrote here that the human DNA is like a computer program that far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. And in order to understand, it's a very good analogy, because actually it's not really an analogy, it's the same technology found in the DNA which is found inside computers. But it's just more advanced. What is in the DNA is an incredibly long molecule that there is a number of four different kinds of molecules which form letters, and these long sequences of these molecules, they write out a long text called the genetic code, and this code is what is actually where all our inherited material is stored. And they also gave just one amazing figure that the amount of information written on each DNA in the in each cell is an amount of information that's equal to, was it 40 volumes of Encyclopedia Britannica. Was one of the largest compilations of information.
Was it 40 times the whole encyclopedia?
Yeah, 40 times the whole encyclopedia. And that's all stored inside a cell. The nucleus of the cell is something like, the nucleus is 1/1000th of a millimeter in size in general. And inside that is stored this amazing amount of information. They also said that if you had just 1 teaspoon of DNA, that all had ever been written in history of mankind could be stored from just one teaspoonful of DNA. And that's one of the great discoveries of the late of the second part of the 20th century, that actually there is information written in our cells. It's not only chemistry, but actually there's a text in there. And it's just like a computer code. And I want to say a little about how computer codes work. You might know that computer codes are just strings of ones and zeros. Everyone knows that, isn't it? How is information stored by just by strings of ones and zeros? But it's supposed to be a code. There are different codes. There's different alphabets, computer alphabets. You can, for example, have an alphabet of where there are six numbers, six ones and zeros, and that's one unit or one letter, or actually what's called one hex. Hex refers to six. I think it's Latin. Is it Latin for six or Greek for six? I'm not sure. You can see that if you combine, you have six ones and zeros. How many times can you how many different combinations are possible with six ones and zeros? You need a quick mathematician.
12 given 6 ones and 6 zeros? 12?
No.
Or just... I'm asking 12 figures or just
no,
six?
Just six figures. How many combinations possible of six ones and zeros? Huh?
2 to the power of 6.
What?
2 to the power of 6.
2 to the power of 6, yeah. And can you explain what that means?
64.
Yeah. No,
it's not
64. 32? I didn't just...
2
of the final 32.
64.
Yeah. So it means if you just have one, then there are two possibilities, one and zero. If you have two, then it's first two, and then it's two. It's 2 by 2, that's 4. And if it's three, then it's 2 by 2 by 2 ways to combine ones and zeros. That's 8. Is that clear to everyone? Mm-hmm. So, again, and then, 16, 32, 64 ways of combining. And if you have 64 possible ways of combining ones and zeros, then actually you can represent 26 letters, 10 numbers, space, start, stop, and also some other figures. And this is actually how computer codes they work. They have just it's written with a particular code, with a particular alphabet. There's a place where there's a symbol that means start. So and then of course you need a reader and a translation system. And then the whole text is written until you get to the symbol that says stop. And then you have a piece of information there. That's how computer codes work. I understand nowadays they actually operate not with six, but with 8, because they need so many more ways to combine. But that's still it's the same principle. And DNA works actually the same way. The genetic code on the DNA works in precisely the same way. There is a, as I say, that there are 4 letters on the 4 chemicals, and in each place there can be 1 out of 4 letters, and so what does that give? How many? I mean, of course, in the first place you have 4. If you have 2 combinations, what is that? 4. 16. 4 by 4.
16.
16, yeah. And then again, 4 by 4 by 4. you have 64. Yeah. And it has turned out that actually in the DNA code, the genetic code is operating with 3 digits and 64 combinations. And why is that? Why does it need 64 combinations? Well, actually it turns out that the genetic code in the on the DNA corresponds to 20 specific kind of molecules called amino acids. I mean, everyone heard the word amino acid. And the amino acids are very important in the body because proteins are made out of amino acids. And we all learn from our mother, you have to be enough proteins, isn't it? Make them strong. Proteins are very important in the body. And proteins are molecules which are actually made of a long strings of amino acids, hundreds of amino acids in set arranged in a long string. And then and these strings again actually they are folded and you know created into all kinds of shapes which perform all kinds of functions inside the bodies, inside our cells. Actually they're machines which are made of proteins, and there are different structures, and you know, so many things are made up out of proteins. And each protein is this particular sequence of, you know, 20 different amino acids, you know, in a long series. And each amino acid is coded for what is called a codon. It's a combination of 3 of these DNA letters, of which there are 64. But there are each of these amino acids is coded for a by a particular combination of these 4 letters. So that on the DNA, each protein is there coded, and then by this particular alphabet. Does it make complete sense to everyone what I'm saying? Did I lose it? Did I just lose everyone?
Better write it down. I mean,
I'm not going to write it down, but I'm going to show another film clip. I'm just trying to explain it so it would be easier to catch it.
Huh?
Here.
I have some computer speakers over in the.
You have. Can I get them quickly? Yep, fantastic. This information on the DNA is being first read by a molecular machine that can read these texts, and then after that it's been translated into building of proteins. And Jai, save us. And it's interesting. Also, this man you're seeing here is an interesting character. His name is Dean Kenyon, and he was, he's still living, but he's a actually quite famous biochemist. And in the 1960s, he was one of the leading researchers in the origin of life, and he was an evolutionist, and he wrote a very famous book that was called Biochemical Predestination, where he was arguing that life could arise spontaneously. Actually, the properties of chemistry is such that life would naturally arise. And that book became very popular, bestseller book. And he was known as a, you know, very big chemist and like one of those. Probably would talk about, he was one of those chemists who believed life could be made from chemistry. But then, some years after he had published his book, he was keep on researching, he started getting some doubts. And of course, the whole interview here with him explains the doubts he had. And ultimately, he became one of the first intelligent design scientists who came out and said, actually, we are dealing with something here that is simply not possible to have risen by itself. He thought that proteins could have risen by themselves. He found out they cannot. And especially when he found that actually there's this link, like chicken, egg, you know, because they have the question, who came first, the chicken or the egg? And that's, you know, it's bewildering. You don't have one without the other. Similarly, we don't have proteins without DNA and DNA without proteins. And the question was, you know, okay, proteins arose first, but then how did DNA come? If you had DNA first, how did proteins? And ultimately, it just it's not possible. It's simply not possible. So this whole story explained like that. And he's telling that. But here we are, you know, the film shows again what happens when proteins are being made from the DNA.
An origin for even the simplest of cells. So the concept of the intelligent design of life was immensely attractive to me and made a great deal of sense, as it very closely matched the multiple discoveries in molecular biology.
In the years since Kenyon's rejection of chemical evolution, science has revealed the details of an entire system of information processing that bears the hallmarks of intelligent design. With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule.
Just stop it. Did you get what happened here? Everyone? Yeah, the DNA is being opened. It's wind up, and in order to read it, it's been opened like that. That's what happened. Okay.
Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcript?
Nej, ikke en fabrik. DNA, det er det er en databank. Det er sådan, det svarer nærmest til, at hvis at du er ude på fabriksgulvet, så er der måske der bliver en bestilling på. Sorry, I should speak English.
Sorry.
Yeah. So he asked, is it DNA like a factory? No, it's not a factory. It's like a databank. And it's like if you're in the factory. Someone, there's an order, we need this particular machine, we have to construct this particular machine. So then the foreman out in on the factory, he will tell, yeah, there's a boy, there's a new boy, he said, go and get the technical drawings for that machine. So the boy, he will run into the data bank, which is, that's a nucleus of the cell. And then he'll go in there and he will look at all the drawers and files and like that. And then one will pull out a drawer. And then he will take up the drawings. And then he'll make a copy. He will not take the original, because the original has to stay, otherwise it'll get lost. But he'll take it up and he'll make a photocopy. He'll make a photocopy of that. put a bottle of that, and then he wrote out, you know, again out of the factory, and here with a photocopy of the, you know, and then they'll have a whole assembly, you know, assembly instructions. You know, first we take this and put this here and this and this here. Actually, this is what's happening, and the DNA is a data bank, and the messenger, this RNA, that's a boy that will bring the messages.
Mission is complete. The slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically...
I don't know if you can see what's happening here precisely. Let's see here. So up here, this is the copy of the DNA that is now being read. These ones you see here, they are, you might say, workers that are bringing the particular molecule needed according to the instruction. The instruction is up here. Each three of these molecules form one particular letter that corresponds to one amino acid. There's one of these that has a, you see actually here on, over here is another, the third one coming, he has three of these, which particularly correspond to one combination of these up there. So when, for example, this guy, he comes here and he finds out, this is my particular combination of letters, they fit together, then he comes and he drops his particular amino acid there. Another one comes, and he finds, this is my combination, he sets his amino acid there, and the third one, and like this, in this way the whole chain is being assembled. Understand?
Is all protein a product of DNA?
Yeah. All the proteins synthesized in the cell is written on the basis of a DNA instructions, yeah.
That makes it very easy to challenge even the learned scientists who are like scholars and talking about like evolution.
Yeah. It's not a physical process. It's actually a digital process. Easy, but again also, you have to also know all the jargon, all the language, and they'll still be able to bewilder you if you just come with this, because they will. There's actually many more complexities to the arguments when you look at it in detail. You can definitely. That's the point. There's definitely no physical process that can create such a system. Dean Kenyon and so he concluded that there's no way. But I say by word documents they can still be built on if you don't know all the technical details.
And is it also extremely fast, huh?
It's fast. Each cell produces something like 1,000 proteins like that a second. it's wild.
It's fast.
It's incredibly fast.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, even though we think we're not doing anything,
yeah,
but so much is happening in every split second in our. I mean,
sequence chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains, often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome.
Huh?
How can they see this?
How can they see this? I mean, that's also very impressive. Actually, they cannot see it. It's too small to see with electron microscopes like that. I mean, you can see this, like even just the structure of the DNA, this double helix structure, you cannot see with DNA. So they have all kinds of indirect ways of analyzing and assessing like that. For example, with the structure of DNA, the way they were analyzing and finally concluded that it was a double helix. You know, understand the word helix, mm-hmm. double spiral. They actually extracted and concentrated DNA, so actually then you had just a crystal of DNA, and then they were shooting laser rays through it and getting a kind of a shadow image on the screen. And then by analyzing the shadow, of course, thousands of hours of work and analysis, they finally concluded it's a double helix. So they have it's all kinds of indirect ways of, and it's, in one sense it's impressive in itself, how they're able to uncover all this and it's going on, and it's like tens of thousands of biochemists involved in this all over the world.
Does everyone agree? I mean, also the opponents, Everyone, everyone agree that this is actually the fact.
Oh yeah, that's not controversial. Mm-hmm. It's simply. Yeah. I mean, there are many things it's just the top of the iceberg they've uncovered, but these things are not coming. That's not being debated. It can be demonstrated practically. For example, genetic engineering, GMO like that. That's they're tinkering with the DNA and the code actually, taking part of the code from a fish and then putting it into a tomato DNA and then they're creating something. This is actually what they're doing.
What would they do to a tomato?
You probably could. Some fish can tolerate temperatures below zero, so maybe you could have a tomato that can. You can freeze a tomato and still be all right, or something. I don't know.
These are genetically modified. I mean, they're not for us to consume, but that's what is happening.
That's what they're doing genetically modified. Yes.
I remember hearing in a lecture they made a fluorescent Christmas tree because some fish are fluorescent.
Yeah, so that's what they're doing, and in one sense it's simple, and the thing is it's harmless like that. But then again, it might not be so harmless after all. It's like sometimes when we, on the computer, you can go into a certain folder, for example, we have the system folder, and when you open that, it says warning, that changing the